On behalf of the Yeshiva University Center for the Jewish Future and the Roots Rabbinic Alumni, I would like to welcome you to this important webcast. My name is Shaul Robinson. I'm currently the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I want to welcome everybody who is taking part in this very, very important webcast conference today. Before I introduce our esteemed panel and welcome everybody who's joining us on the World Wide Web or on the telephone conference, allow me just to make a couple of words of introduction. We gather together today virtually on Asarah B'Tevet, the fast day of the 10th of Tevet. And of course, we are very conscious and very much a mispalel for this very difficult time for Achenu Beis Yisrael, the people of Israel, many of whom are literally besieged on this Asarah B'Tevet on the day in which we commemorate the original siege of Yerushalayim. We're here to talk about a different kind of siege, an economic siege. And every rabbi, without question, has seen economic difficulty, some tragedies descend suddenly without warning and in unexpected ways on our community, our institutions, and on many members of the community. In last week's Torah reading of Vayigash, Rashi tells us that when Yaakov Avinu went down to Egypt, it was his power of bracha, of blessing to Pharaoh, that made that incredibly deep economic crisis, the 7 years of famine, suddenly came to an end. There isn't a rabbi in the world who does not wish with all his heart that a mere bracha, a tefillah, heartfelt as Yaakov's Avinu, would give us the ability to ease the economic situation of our balabatim. Alas, for the vast majority of us in any case, that is not the case. And therefore we're forced to think of eitzot, of practical measures in which we can be supportive to the community, to its institutions, and most importantly to our members and to Jewish families at this very, very difficult time. I'd like to thank the Center for the Jewish Future for co-hosting this event. The CJF's mission statement is to shape, enrich, and inspire the contemporary Jewish community by convening the resources of Yeshiva University to infuse the student body with the spirit of leadership and sense of Klal Yisrael, to build, cultivate, and support communities, rabbinic and lay leaders and individuals, and to create a global movement that promotes the values of Yeshiva University. And the other co-host is Reitz Rabbinic Alumni, which serves as a vehicle by which former Talmidim of Reitz can continue experiencing the spirit, air of enthusiasm and excitement which filled their formative student years. And that organization is active in many, many ongoing events, Yumeiyun and training events for rabbis out dealing with difficult situations such as the economic crisis. I want to welcome everybody who is joining us as part of this webcast. There are rabbis from all different denominations. There are rabbis calling in from all parts of the United States, from Canada, and from Europe. Our speakers are going to be in the following order. Dr. John Malandateros, Mr. Andrew Lauer, Esquire, Rabbi Yossi Stern, and Rabbi Herschel Billet. I'm going to say a word about each of them before I introduce them. First of all, Dr. John Malandateros is an associate professor of finance at the Cy Sims School of Business. He's been a member of the faculty here since 2001. He teaches various courses, including the principles of finance, advanced corporate finance, international finance, and portfolio management. Prior to joining the Yeshiva University faculty, he taught at St. John's University as an associate professor of finance and was a money manager at Salomon Smith Barney. Dr. Malandateros is particularly going to concentrate on what has happened to the economy, how deep and how bad things are going to get before they get in any way better.
Thank you, Rabbi Robinson. Essentially, I shall talk about what has happened and what will happen with this financial crisis. I shall be brief about what has happened. Essentially, we've had almost an international financial meltdown, which, thank God, did not happen finally. It was started by the housing crisis, subprime mortgage issuance. It led into the destruction of value of financial institutions. It led into the failure of financial institutions like Lehman Brothers, and a major mistake there that was made to let it fail. And it precipitated the worldwide financial meltdown, or close to that. We have basically avoided a meltdown financially, and we're looking forward to have improved conditions. However, I think what will happen is not going to be easy, and it's not going to be easily. It's not going to be an easy approach to improvement. I think that what will happen in the next couple of years will be both positive and negative things. One, as far as the bad things are concerned, I think unemployment will worsen, GDP will fall further, and business activity will worsen, as well as housing prices will probably fall till this summer time of this year. But there are some positive things that will happen, and I think that will be cheap prices, as an example, gas prices as well as rents. And positive things that will continue happening will be that financial markets will stabilize further. And by stabilization, I mean actual improvement. I think the stock market and the bond market, and I can't tell you when exactly, but in the next 2 years, they will do much better. And the reason for that is that risk will decline. And when risk declines, financial prices increase. Also, I think housing will start picking up by the end of the year. And it will be one of the bright spots of the economy. And housing is counter-cyclical. We can discuss why that will happen later in the questions and answers. But I think housing will be a bright spot in the next year coming. Another important thing that will happen is that the government will hire massively. We are talking about $1 trillion that will be spent additionally to the federal budget. And it will create jobs of $1 trillion. Through the multiplier effect, that will be $2 trillion after about a year. So the government will be a major producer of economic activity and a major employer. How long will it last? This is a recession that has started supposedly the end of 2007. Already a year has passed. Most recessions last for a year or less. This one is much nastier, probably will last a year more. So we are looking for the recession continuing until the end of the year. It could be until the summer that's coming. As far as sectors to be affected, there will be some sectors, most sectors will be affected negatively, of course, as I have described. Financial services is a prime example of that. Luxury sales will suffer. Diamond necklaces, expensive coats, and so on. Tourism will be affected. Unfortunately, Israel depends a lot on tourism. That will be affected negatively because people forsake traveling when things are not so well financially. As far as positive sectors, I think that collection agencies will do well, healthcare will do well, and government jobs will do well. So in a nutshell, I think that we have had a huge financial crisis, but we are turning the corner. I think that housing will start leading the economic recovery because it's counter-cyclical. So sometime in the last 6 months of 2009, housing is going to pull up the economy. In addition to housing, of course, and connected with it, furniture will do well, appliances will do well, and then eventually by 2010, the economy will start turning the corner because there is a massive fiscal stimulus going on, $1 trillion. Now they are talking about also a huge tax cut to the tune of $300 billion. Together, $1 trillion more spending with $300 tax cut will be a huge jolt to the economy that will be a positive stimulus. In addition, of course, as far as monetary policy is concerned, the Federal Reserve, together with the U.S. Treasury, have been very vigilant and very vigorous in putting a lot of money into the system, as well as doing amazing new things, which will stimulate the economy with some time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor. Our next contributor is Andrew Lauer, Esquire. Mr. Lauer is the Vice President for Legal Affairs and Secretary and General Counsel of Yeshiva University. In this capacity, Mr. Lauer is responsible for all legal matters pertaining to the university and its affiliates, both within the United States and abroad. Mr. Lauer also serves as counsel to the President of the university. Prior to his appointment at Yeshiva University, Mr. Lahr was a partner of the international law firm Thalen Reed Brown Reisman & Steiner LLP, where he maintained a large and diverse practice, while also serving as an active member of the Labour and Employment Law Department of that firm. Mr. Lahr served as a relationship partner to numerous clients in relation to various areas of legal specialty, including corporate real estate, litigation technology, outsourcing, bankruptcy, patent and trademark. He often functioned as outside general counsel to many companies. Prior to that, he had extensive experience as senior employment counsel in the Office of General Counsel for PricewaterhouseCoopers PwC Consulting. Mr. Lahr has published numerous articles and has conducted training and seminars in various areas of the law through the United States and abroad. He is also, as it happens, a past president of Young Israel Woodmere, Rabbi Billet's synagogue. We'll be hearing from Rabbi Billet soon, and is the current chairman of the board of the Hafter School in Long Island. Mr. Lahr.
Thank you, Rabbi Robinson. When Rabbi Robinson called me last night and he told me I had 8 minutes to speak this morning, it struck me as ironic because 8 minutes was generally the time frame as president of the shul that I tried to have the rabbi speak for in the drasha. So I'm going to give my 8 minutes in rabbi time, so that's about 20, 25 minutes, and we'll call this the president's revenge, although with my rabbi he always gets the last word and he's the last speaker today, so I'll probably regret those comments. On a more serious note, aside from my my official capacities here at Young Israel, at the, I'm sorry, at Yeshiva University, I, as Rabbi Robinson said, I'm a former labor and employment partner at an international law firm, and in that capacity, combined with my lay activity within the Five Towns community on Long Island, I have been over the years often called upon to give advice to individuals that are out of work or having employment issues. So I'm going to focus my comments this morning in the area of labor and employment and try to give the Rabbanim that are on this call some background as to issues that they should be aware of when Balabatim come to them in this environment when they are having employment issues. One thing I do want to point out is that when I had my private practice, one of the things that I found was very useful was trying to be the trusted advisor of my clients. And that means that they would come to me, I would want them to come to me with any issue, and I'd be able to help them, whether it was my area of expertise or not. I think clearly Rabbanim fall into the trusted advisor capacity. And just as I, in my private practice, tried to have a cadre of people to refer people to, not to solve all the problems, but to have a good network of people that I could say, you know, I'm sorry you're having this problem, let me give you this phone number, let me call so-and-so, and they could assist you. I think that's a very important capacity for a rabbi to fulfill, to have a network within your community of lawyers and advisors, and we'll go through some of that in a moment, who could help your balabatim. When focusing on the area of employment law, I think it's extremely relevant because, unfortunately, as we've heard, unemployment is extremely high right now. It'll probably get a little bit worse before it gets better. And you have a lot of people out there who are impacted by this, losing their jobs, that have done nothing wrong. It's merely the economy that's causing this. Generally, these are people who have been successful in their careers, have never had issues like this before, have gone to good schools, gotten good jobs, whether it's on Wall Street or law firms or wherever they're working, and they've never experienced this type of downturn in their lives. And it's extremely traumatic to them. And I think it's something that's important, that we all appreciate the trauma that these people are going through. And I think what's most important to point out to them is that they're not alone in this, that this is a situation that the country is facing, that the world is facing, and that they're not alone, and this too will pass. Going into some specifics. So someone comes into you and says, I was fired from my job last week. I've been at this company for 25 years. You know, what do I do?
So as I said earlier, I think one of the first things you could try to do is put them in touch with some professionals who could assist and give them good advice. Someone had pointed out it's helpful if you have this cadre of people that they understand that this is an act of chesed, that they're not going to, you know, hopefully they're not going to be charging people for this. If I give you a phone number, if I give someone your number and I ask them to call you, just give them 5 minutes of your time. It'll mean a lot to them. When someone is terminated, so what do they do and what are some of the things that are helpful to you to be aware of? First thing is I think it's not useful to argue about the decision. I think that by the time these decisions occur and the actions occur, management has gone through substantial evaluations, they've spoken to lawyers. I mean, this has been going on for a while before the employee actually finds out about it. It's not terribly helpful to argue about it, although you should protect your rights and make sure that decisions are being made for appropriate reasons. Try to keep good notes when people are when you're in a termination meeting, and ask. It's okay to ask questions. Why was I laid off? Why was I selected? Am I going to receive my accrued vacation? Am I going to get severance? All those questions are appropriate. You will likely have a release given to you, a separation letter or a severance agreement. They're all the same thing. Basically, it's a legal document saying that if we give you severance, and hopefully the individual will be getting some sort of severance or additional benefit than they're otherwise entitled to, that document will contain a legal release. That release releases the employer from all liability. So it's very important that the individual consult with an attorney or at least someone knowledgeable of those documents so that they're certain that they're not releasing rights that they need not release. Many employers will include, for example, certain legal requirements in the release. If you're over 40 years of age, you'll have a clause in there that'll say you have 21 days to consider the release, 7 days to revoke it. It's all statutory. If there's more than one person being terminated, there should be a list of other individuals who are impacted. And just also bear in mind, state law is applicable as well. So if you're, you should also be aware that your particular state might have certain laws that are different, although the ones I'm referring to are federal and apply all over. Very important to have someone review that release before you sign it. WARN notice is something we're hearing about now. Employers under certain technical circumstances are required to give notice of an upcoming layoff. It doesn't apply all the time. It's actually a fairly limited set of circumstances where it does apply. I'm not going to go into the details. It's very technical, but another issue that an attorney or somebody that's knowledgeable should review. The reason why I'm mentioning this is because there are certain lawsuits that are coming out now involving some of the larger investment banks where they're alleging that they didn't give proper WARN notice. It's just an avenue of relief. Unemployment benefits, generally someone will be entitled to unemployment benefits, and that varies from state to state. You can go onto the state website to get information on unemployment benefits. It is a subspecialty or a niche area, so it might be hard to find someone that has background in unemployment benefits, but the Department of Labor in your particular state should be aware of that. Unpaid wages, accrued vacation, again, it's statutory as to what's required to be paid, but generally employers will pay back accrued vacation. Certainly they must pay unpaid wages. Discrimination claims are also things that you should be cognizant of. That's something that you discuss. So, for example, if someone calls me and asks me to review a release, generally I will also ask about the circumstances leading up to the situation to cover that. COBRA benefits, individuals should be entitled under most circumstances to continued health benefits at a slight premium. It's generally 102% of the premium. But you should be entitled, or the individual should be entitled, to health benefits for a period of approximately 18 months. That's very important as well, because one of the things that your Baal HaBatim will be concerned about is their health benefits in addition to financial issues. Again, some states have specific guidelines in this area as well, so be cognizant of that. In the area of employment law, I think the bottom line is that people need to get advice when they're separating from a company. They do have certain rights, and you want to make sure that they're getting what they're entitled to. But, you know, again, the feeling of compassion and understanding what the person is going through is extremely important. A couple other areas of law that might be relevant might be bankruptcy. For example, I had an individual call me up that said they had received severance payable over 6 months, and during the six-month period, the company went bankrupt. So do they still get their severance benefits? Sometimes if you're terminated and you want to do independent contracting or consulting, you might need to set up a separate company because employers want you to be part of a separate company when you're working as an independent contractor very often. That's an area where a corporate lawyer might be helpful. Real estate, you know, the people might have issues with their mortgages and they need help with issues with banks and mortgages in their homes. Real estate is another area. Investment advisors are also an important area to have as part of your network of people you can refer your Balabhatim to, because generally if you're coming out of an employment situation, you might have a retirement plan, a 401k or something like that, that needs to be rolled over into something, and they need some advice on how to coordinate their finances. Recruiters and headhunters obviously are helpful. In addition, simple things like maybe a writer or an English professor to help people with their resumes. Again, another area that might be helpful. And of course, networking is key. So one of the benefits of being part of a community might be the resources of the other individuals in the community, not necessarily people that will hire you, but maybe people who could introduce you, get you introductions, and maybe help your Balabhatim get back on their feet. So again, just to summarize, I think the best value a Rav could add to one of their Balabhatim in this situation is compassion, is understanding that this is an extremely traumatic situation. They've probably never experienced something like this before. They believe, you know, their whole world is collapsing around them. Just hold their hands, push them through, advise them and refer them to the right people, and reassure them that several years down the road, or hopefully sooner, they'll look back at this as just another bump in the road and a bad experience, and they too will get through this. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Our next contributor is Rabbi Yossi Stern. Rabbi Stern is the founder and executive director of the Bergen County-based Project Ezra. 7 years ago, Rabbi Stern saw a need to help those in his community who had lost their jobs and had nowhere to turn. Project Ezra emerged as a grassroots organization in that effort, starting with a single task initially to help families pay for health insurance. Under Rabbi Stern's guidance, Ezra has developed and grown into an organization which has been nationally recognized. Project Ezra's unique approaches and its success rate in achieving appropriate goals for its candidates have caused their methods to be recognized as a blueprint for community chesed works. In today's economic crisis, many communities now recognize what Project Ezra saw 7 years ago. In that regard, they have approached Rabbi Stern in the launch stages of setting up similar aid for their own residents, and it's that experience and advice that we turn to Rabbi Stern to help us with today.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Robinson. I'm going to try in the brief couple of minutes that I have to describe who we try to help and how we try to help them. We try to help people that are out of work find jobs. We try to take advantage of contacts that we have. When we help people find jobs, what we try to do is first to see whether they are job ready. We ask people to submit their resumes. We ask for two references, professional, one personal. And after those have been checked, we meet with the candidate. The people who deal with employment have first and foremost as their mission to let the candidate know that we are there to help them. We're there to help them in their search and while they are searching. 7 years ago, five years ago, after 9/11, there was a tremendous downturn in the IDT arena. many of the people then were facing that there was a tremendous shrinkage in jobs in that arena. And so we embarked upon situations whereby we would try to see whether they can be retrained where possible to do something other than what they had done in the past. So in that regard, let me perhaps share with you one story which may drive home what people might have to at least consider. There was a rabbi who was a menahel of a day school or of day schools over a 35-year period of time. And after that period of time, those opportunities ceased to exist for this individual. It was around that time that we were fortunate to meet up with an individual who created a opportunity for people to retrain to become licensed nursing home administrators. This individual wanted to join that program, and when I originally contacted this individual that here we have one person who would like to do this, he originally was not too interested. He figured he was too old, maybe he wasn't the kind of person that he wanted. I let this sit for about a day, and then I called him again. I said, what does it bother you? Let him take the course. He took the course, and he wound up passing whatever tests and requirements he needed to do in May. In April, they had bought a brand new nursing home, and in June, he became the director of that nursing home. And from that time on until today, the person has a new, fine career. He's able to support his family, and he's very happy with what he's doing. The other thing that I think people need to at least entertain, and this is something that I think every Rav has more resources at his fingertips than he's aware of. This Sunday, for example, in our community, we have a job-a-thon where we have 18 lines set up. We have three shifts of 2 hours apiece. So we have 54 people that will be calling different people in the community to see what job opportunities that they have. From the time that we promoted this concept, we've already gotten in 100 different job opportunities that are now available for us to see whether they match up with our clients. And lastly, which I think is just as important and very important, there are very many people who have been let go from professions that may be actually qualified to work in a different kind of job, but at a much lower salary. And people need to take into consideration that given that opportunity, the sooner they get back on the saddle, the better off they're going to be. Because if they're going to wait until they're able to get the same kind of job that they used to have, the amount of money that they will eat up, either from their severance or from their savings, may be much more detrimental than taking a job at a lower income until the economy bounces back. With all of that, there are many people who through this period of time, like they were after 9/11, and throughout, are financially distressed. And we realize that people that are distressed financially and for other reasons would have a very difficult time even presenting properly when they went for interviews, even if they got interviews. And so therefore we decided that in order to help those people, we needed to be willing to help people in other arenas as well. We needed to be willing to offer financial assistance in a way to perhaps make up a shortfall. But we realized that a shortfall can come about for either one of two reasons, either because of a lack of income or a reduced income, or because of mismanagement. And very often it's a combination of the two. And so therefore we decided from many years ago that in order to try to give someone financial assistance, we didn't want to serve the capacity of just being a Band-Aid. And therefore we decided that in order to help somebody, there is a tremendous amount of due diligence that needs to go in to helping someone. It's incumbent upon anyone who has any resources at their disposal, because no matter how much resources one may have, one rub, one community may have, they're still very limited. And therefore, in order to deal with the funds that we do have at our disposal, we need to handle it in a way whereby we know what it is that the money we're giving is going for, and is it actually helpful? And especially in today's times, as we've heard from our two previous illustrious presenters, there are, on one hand, opportunities, and there are, on one hand, realities. And how you deal with the reality needs to be given a tremendous amount of thought. And therefore, it would, I think, be exceedingly helpful for anyone who's trying to help anyone financially. And we receive many phone calls and many visits all the time in terms of how to deal with this. Even if people set up significant funds, they're still not significant. And so therefore, in my opinion, it would be helpful, and it's available to you. Ask accountants within your community, ask people who can do analysis to make sure that they actually study and understand the problem. Let them go through people's numbers, bank statements, credit card statements. Let's identify what it is that is actually helpful, what a person needs firstly to live, and how that will get accomplished, and separate that from whatever debts people might have, because that might be a secondary situation, and the two of them need to get identified. And people should reach out to attorneys in the community, to accountants in the community, and they're available. All you have to do is really share with people that all you want to do is help other people within your communities, and let them understand that ani eircha kodmin, and let them understand that on one hand, the first level of tzedakah in the Rambam's 8 steps is to help people find work. Let people know that we're there to help them find work. You can do it through networking, but use that networking. Speak about that people should avoid the historical taboo of not wanting to hire people that you know, not wanting to hire people that you perceive might be impossible or difficult to fire. If we're not going to hire our own, then why should anyone else? So therefore, I strongly advise that it might be helpful for you to speak about from the pulpit. Please, if you have jobs, look to see whether there are people within the community who might have just as good qualifications that you might employ them. Speak about if people have jobs, let it be known. Send it out in newsletters. Publicize it any which way that you can and let people have access to it. And I believe that if we are going to convey to our congregants that we should be compassionate for each other, then I believe that the Maamar of Chazal will come true. And that is Kol HaMerachim Al HaBrios Merachim En Olam Min HaShemayim. Anyone who has compassion on other human beings, God has compassion on them. And together, we can make a significant difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Rabbi Stern. I want to say that after our next presenter, Rabbi Billet, who will be the last speaker, there'll be an opportunity for people to contribute to by asking questions. First of all, for those people who are participating on the telephone conference, please remember to have your phones muted as we get a little bit of feedback here at this end. People after the next presentation will be able to ask questions. You can do so by emailing rabbinicalumni@yu.edu. That's rabbinicalumni, all one word, at yu.edu, with webcast in the subject line. Our fourth speaker is Rabbi Herschel Billet, who is the rabbi of the Young Israel of Woodmere. And I'll leave it to his discretion whether he uses his presidential 8 minutes or not. Rabbi Billet is the senior rabbi of Young Israel of Woodmere. He has undergraduate degree from Yeshivat University and smicha from the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, and a master's degree in Jewish history from Bernard Ravel Graduate School. Rabbi Billet is a leading activist on behalf of Israel and Zionist causes on both sides of the Green Line and the board member of the Western World Heritage Foundation. He's a popular lecturer all over the world, a past president of the Rabbinic Council of America, the RCA. Rabbi Billet remains strongly involved in the affairs of the RCA, having also served as chairman of its Vad HaKavod, its Israel Committee, its Katrina, and its Gush Katif Relief Committees, and much more. He's an active member of the OU and serves on the board as a member of its Israel Commission. Rabbi Billet has already made a name for himself in Woodmere in this current economic crisis as being a role model and having thought out strategies for helping people in economic crisis. And it's those ideas that we have from Abilet to share with us this morning.
Thank you very much. I just want to say that as being part of the panel, we in Woodmere have benefited from Yeshiva University, from Project Ezra, and from our former president, Mr. Avi Lauer. And so it's really good to be able to join a representative of the faculty of Yeshiva University and the two other presenters this morning. Okay, I want to start with a very brief Dvar Torah, one that I think should be relevant to all of us who are out there to help people. And to just abbreviate a thought that the Beis Halevi said in last week's Torah reading. The Talmud tells us that we have to worry for the day of judgment and for the day that God chastises us. And we learn it from the words of Joseph to his brothers. And what were the words of Joseph to his brothers? I am Joseph. Ani Yosef, Ha'od Avichai, is my father still alive? And then he says, I am Joseph, please, the brother that you sold to Egypt, please come forward. So when you look at this, it's really incomprehensible. Where did Joseph chastise his brothers? And what kind of question did he ask his brothers? I am Joseph, is my father still alive? They really couldn't answer that question because they had traveled from Palestine, from the land of Israel to Egypt, and there were no cell phones, there was no emails. They had no way of really knowing if Jacob was still alive. So the Beis Halevi, Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik of Brisk, explains, he said, what Joseph did to his brothers was he stopped them in their tracks. Because Judah was making a plea to Joseph. He said, you know, if you keep Benjamin as a hostage, you are going to bring my father to his grave. My father couldn't stand losing his son. So Joseph says, the first thing he says to his brothers when he tells them that he's Joseph, he says, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? You're so concerned that my father will be killed? And what about when you sold me to Egypt? Did you consider that you might be killing your father then? And the brothers were stunned by the remarks because they knew he was right. And then he tells them, I'm your brother, please come forward. But the point is that he made the statement, you have to think at a particular moment in time about the consequences for others. And I think that for many of us facing this economic crisis is the opportunity when we could say that we either sat on the side while other people were suffering, or we stepped forward and we understood what our responsibilities are. Now, the way I see it, there are three issues that a rabbi in a community has to face today as you service particularly a Jewish community. Some of them would be relevant to other communities as well, but I'm talking specifically in the context of the Jewish community because we have one element that some in the general community have that many don't. The first issue area that we have to address, and they've been addressed eloquently by the previous speakers, is the community itself. In addition to Project Ezra, there are two wonderful projects in Israel. One is called Mesilah, which functions primarily in the more Haredi community, and one is called Pa'amonim, which functions both in the Haredi community and the Tzioni Dati community. And all three are efforts to do the kinds of things that Rabbi Stern described. For our community, the challenge of putting together what we now call the Eliezer Project brought about community unity. All the different segments, we are a much varied community, a very vibrant community, but we have people from all different streams within the community. We brought us all together. There's one address now, and the address has multiple tabs. Rabbi Stern and Mr. Lauer in particular describe them very, very well. We're trying to help people deal with issues relating to their mortgages, credit card debt, foreclosure, budget management, unemployment, resume writing, interviewing skills, unemployment insurance, and how to apply for unemployment insurance and not get turned down, and how to make the painful cuts that people have to make in their budget. And I'm not here to speak about those specific issues, but in general, those are the kinds of things that had to be addressed. We also reached out to Rav Aaron Cutler of Lakewood, who's a genius in terms of understanding the availability of all sorts of different government programs, which are there to assist the public. Now, he's in the state of New Jersey, and I'm sure that we're in the state of New York, and I'm sure in any state of the United States that you're in, there are government programs, and you have to make use of that. You have to network. So one area that is very important is the area of community and the effort that the community can make. There were also descriptions made before of reaching out, not being shy, and reaching out to the many, many talented people in the community who have different skills to offer. It might be legal skills, it might be accounting skills, it might be retraining somebody to do a kind of job, to offer a job. All of those things are very important. The second thing that a synagogue rabbi has to consider is servicing the congregants. To recognize that each congregant is an individual, every congregant is entitled to their privacy and their dignity. Every rabbi also has to know their limits, A, in terms of their ability, B, in terms of the funds that are available, and C, to have the capacity to say, I can't do this, but I know somebody else who can do this, and I'd like to make an introduction for you. Sometimes you can make an introduction to someone who's been through it before, someone who's going through it before, to create ad hoc support groups within the community. And always, as was said earlier by Mr. Lauer, to have compassion. We also established in our community a chesed committee. There are people who are unemployed, both mothers and fathers, who have to go out for work, and they can't be at home when their kids come home from school. They can't prepare meals. So there are people who are prepared to prepare meals for others, to give babysitting service, to do shopping for others, just to make life easier, to ease the burden and to share in the pain of the other. So that's the second area, the area that each rabbi can do in the context of the community that is being serviced by that rabbi. And the third area, the one that is most unique to our community, although not exclusive to the Jewish community, is private school education. We are very, very insistent, most of us, that our children receive a good, solid Jewish education because we believe that is the essence of Jewish continuity. Now, when I said the word good, good means every parent wants their child to be educated with outstanding teachers. And that means both in Judaica and in their secular studies. And outstanding teachers cost money. Schools have tremendous, tremendous overhead. With this new tuition crisis that has hit us, with this new economic crisis that's hit us, there are many parents who are not able to pay tuition like they were able to. Full tuition paying parents become, and sometimes half tuition paying parents or no tuition paying parents. Tuition goes down, that means the schools lose money. The schools also rely on other sources of fundraising, and if people can't make contributions, the schools don't have money. And yet the parents want a very, very good education for their children. And for many young families, the amounts of money that they have to pay, putting together a mortgage on the house, if you live in a community where there are private homes, or to pay rent, if you live in a community where there are high rentals, and to pay tuition, is extraordinarily stressful on the family budget. So there has to be a tremendous effort, and why Yeshiva University, actually the Center for the Jewish Future and Yeshiva University, has taken a leadership role also. We had a program in our community, all the schools together, talking about the tuition crisis, what we can do to try to keep the schools functioning at a high level and also help the parents support their kids. And one last point that I think that relates to everything, people have to also come down to earth and they have to live within the context of the realities. Some people might be used to a lot of luxury things, such as 10 days or 8 days away for Passover. They might be used to taking nice trips. They might be used to spending money on certain things. People also have to be taught to prioritize in the context of community, in the context of their synagogues and their schools, in the context of their tuition. They have to know what's important and what's not important, and people are going to have to make some painful cuts. And as clergymen, it's our responsibility to give them the tough message, even if we become a little less popular for doing it. But sometimes somebody has to say, a parent has to say to a child, no. And that also is part of our role, perhaps the hardest part of our role, but a very essential part of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Rabbi Billet. Once again, I would like to invite people to submit questions by email to rabbinicalumni@yu.edu. I want to take this opportunity of thanking all of our speakers for the presentation so far, and to kick off the discussion. We heard from the professor before that the economic crisis is something which is going to affect at least many levels of the economy for another year or so. With that being the case, I would like to ask one or two of the panelists I have in mind, specifically the rabbis, to comment about whether or not this is a time that we should be expending tzedakah resources in actually putting financial assistance towards people. Or is this a time where we should be looking at accruing tzedakah resources to carry people through what may well be an extended period of hardship? One of the questions that, and therefore I'd like to ask a couple of our panelists to comment on, is what is the role of financial assistance? When is it appropriate to write a check? When is it appropriate to give a balabas, an unemployed family, actually a cash sum? Rabbi Stern would like to comment on that first of all.
The policy that we have in Project Ezra is, number one, we don't really give anyone a large sum of money. We may spend a large sum of money on a given family, but we're not giving them a large sum of money. Generally, after we identify what it is that a family needs to survive, needs to live, needs to cover its bills, at the same time, we figure out what their income can cover. And if we know what their income can't cover, then we'll pay certain bills. But what we want to also make sure of is that the monies that we give, A, are going to the right sources, and that the family who we are assisting at this particular time, since they're the beneficiaries of charitable dollars, which is really mammon hektish, holy money, they're living fiscally responsible lives. Just to touch on something that Rabbi Bilett mentioned towards the end of his presentation, there's a beautiful quote from the Maggid of Yerushalayim, who said, "Pam hayurotzim, mashet tzrichim, hayom tzrichim, masherotzim, zechurban dareinu." Once upon a time, people wanted what they needed. Today, people need what they want. And that's been our downfall. What I always try to transmit, and the people that work for us try to transmit, is what we call, I saw it in a book called Shvila Zahav, Tochnit Chamash, which stands for Chayim Mimash Yesh. People have to live from what they have. And so therefore, if people who are giving charitable dollars, people who have charitable dollars to give, they're entitled to feel that the monies that they're giving are being treated with fiscally. It's not just being given to somebody because they may tell us a very heart-wrenching story, but at the end of the day, that money could be going to someplace that's actually a waste. There was a rabbi who visited with me before I came in here, together with this, I guess, treasurer or president, and they were discussing, you know, they had already given one specific family $15,000 or $20,000, and that money was given to credit cards. I said, why did you do that? I mean, does the family have enough to live? Do you know that they have enough to live? Why don't you first make sure that you know that they have enough to live? And credit cards, the worst that can happen, if a family doesn't have enough to live, maybe it'll be a judgment against them. But that's a separate thing that has to get ascertained. You can't really take, in most cases, charitable dollars and just give them to people lump sum if you don't know that the money is actually going for where it needs to go and it's actually solving something.
I'm privileged to live in a community where the members of my community are extraordinarily generous. I have at my fingertips a rather significant charity fund, I think, compared to what most rabbis have, but there are limits to any charity fund. And as Rabbi Stern said, charity money has to be spent very, very cautiously. It's holy money. Next week, let me put in a little advertisement from Tuesday, January 13th, I see that Rabbi Golden is going to be speaking about balancing affluence and Torah values in the next seminar that YU is conducting on this subject. The question has come up about limiting the charity that goes out of the community because of Aniyei Yir Club, because we have poor people in our community. I think there's something to be said for community drives and community fundraising to be done for our local schools and our local social service institutions, things that we may not have had to do to such an extent in the past. I don't believe, however, that we should completely stop giving charity. We should give charity responsibly. There are needs in other parts of the world, and I'm a big believer in that if you need something and you do it for somebody else, you also get some reward for that as well. So I'm not in favor, I'm not in favor of completely cutting off the rest of the world from charity. I do believe that we have to put greater emphasis on our communities today and direct more of our fundraising that we may have done for others towards our community. And I also think that rabbis should not get too emotionally involved with one particular case and blow all their money on one case, and then you wind up not having anything for anybody else. You have to remember that community money belongs to the entire community, and so you have to be careful, and you have to just know your turf. Know what's out there, know where you can refer people and where they can get help, and try to be very judicious in the money that you spend on people and try to share the wealth as best as you can.
Many thanks. Next question comes from a web viewer in Yerushalayim, and it's directed to Dr. Maladretos. Exactly how bad is the unemployment situation? Meaning, percentage-wise, how many more people are unemployed today than were, say, a year ago? How much worse do you expect it to get? And when do you expect the employment situation specifically to begin to improve?
The unemployment increase this past year was close to 2 million people, an increase of 2 more million people. And at the present time, we're hovering around 7% unemployment rate. The likely case is that that will worsen. It could worsen, according to some investment bank forecasts, to 9%. 9% is approximately 3 million more people out of work. And the reason unemployment really is a lagging indicator. In other words, it comes along after business activity declines substantially, and then firms start laying off people. So in the next year, unemployment will get worse, because remember, we are now in the second part, if you will, of that economic decline, which started at the beginning of last year, or end of 2007. So unemployment will get worse for about a year more as firms' activity has declined. Retail sales are down substantially, luxury sales especially. IPOs, financial sales are down substantially, or financial firms. So unemployment will get worse. About every million of people laid off is about 0.7% of unemployment increase. But I think that will probably stop around the end of this year. And in 2010, I think employment will improve. Now, these are estimates. I'm not sure that unemployment will get worse till December of 2009. It's possible that unemployment will get worse until the summer and turn around after the summer. It really depends on many factors that I can't determine. There is an econometric model, the Pennsylvania Wharton econometric model, that has 1,000 equations, and that model sometimes forecasts incorrectly, because many of those regressors, as we call them, determinants, alter substantially. But the employment situation, I am almost sure, will get worse as firms see that they need to lay off people. And a few of them had a policy not to lay off people, and they have been so hurt that they absolutely need to lay off people. However, I think that starting in the winter, February or March of this year, the government will spend so much money that it will have an effect. You're going to have the forces of evil versus the forces of good. And the forces of evil will be the situation creating unemployment. the government will create a lot of jobs. As I said, if those $2 trillion that will be created, a trillion by the government, as well as a second round of effects, because you know someone will get a job fixing a road, he will go and buy groceries, and the grocer now will buy supplies from the initial producer, that multiplier effect of $2 trillion will be fighting the forces of unemployment. And I think, humanly speaking now, because there's always the divine element, and we don't know what the Almighty has in mind, but of course I walk with trepidation talking in the presence of so many knowledgeable rabbis, but if we're talking about humanly speaking, according to all the scientific evidence we have, the intervention by both the monetary authorities, such as the Federal Reserve, and the fiscal spending should definitely help out. It should help out an initial, it should really, by the end of the year, beginning of 2010, we could have an amazing growth. That's possible. All that stimulus, the fiscal stimulus and the monetary stimulus, could really have a great effect. But I think that we need to separate the financial markets from the real markets. The financial markets usually are more fragile, more unstable. That's the reason it was unacceptable that Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail, because it created a tidal wave. But financial markets have stabilized to a great extent, and they will do well because the stock market, for example, is a leading indicator. So the stock market will do well sometime this coming year, forecasting that the economy will do well, especially in 2010. The stock market leads the economy by 6 to 9 months. So when we see the stock market rising substantially, it is an indicator. It is not a definitive answer that the economy is going to pick up. It's saying to us that the economy is going to do well. By economy, we mean gross domestic product will be rising, employment will be rising, retail sales will be rising, all the items that indicate an economic growth.
Thank you very much. Questions are coming in. First of all, a question from a rabbi in Toronto. And this is addressed, I'm actually going to ask Mr. Lahr to address this first. How do we preserve the privacy of the tzedakah recipient when calling upon community resources? The tzedakah and professional resources when chavra de chavra is lay. In other words, how do you preserve the one hand of a community-based approach to charity at the same time protecting people's right to dignity and privacy in these very hands-on community networking approaches that we're talking about? And as a follow-up, how do you properly triage our resources? Is it the people who are first online, the people who ask loudest, the people who have more friends in the community and are able to march the way into the rabbi's office? Who are the ones who we decide how to get the most specific help? I'm going to ask Mr. Lahr first of all, and then Rabbi Stern.
Thank you. In terms of the privacy, I think that, again, you're dealing with professionals generally. You're referring these individuals to professionals who are used to the obligation of privacy and confidentiality. Obviously, I believe you also need to inform your balabatim, the individual, that, is it okay if I speak with so-and-so and tell him that you're going to call? I think that privacy and dignity go together, and people do consider a lot of this to be extremely private, and to some extent, I think at the earlier stages of this economic downturn, people were much more close to the vest. I think now it's not uncommon to hear of people out of work, so people are a little bit more open, which is beneficial to them as well. Unfortunately, the more people that know that they are looking, that they're out of work, that they need help, the more likely that the help is going to come. So I think in terms of privacy with the people you're referring them to, it's important to ask permission of the individual before you speak with someone, but that the individuals that you're referring them to are professionals who understand confidentiality and the value of it. I know in my home, when people come, Very often it'll be on a Sunday when my whole family is out, and nobody will even know that someone came to the house. I don't tell my wife, I don't tell anybody. And then months later, someone might say to my wife, oh, you know, it was very nice that your husband helped me. Confidentiality is important. It's important to maintain the dignity of the individual. In terms of triage of resources, I think that's a very, very good point. I think you need to have two layers of individuals. The initial point person, who might be more of a general contact, someone who could speak to the individual, and then that person should have better or deeper resources. So, for example, when someone might come to me, or when I was at my law firm, so generally I represented management and corporations, I would sit and speak to the individual, understand the situation, and then based on that discussion, I would have a better idea of who from my Rolodex I would want to refer that person to specifically. So I think as a Rav, you should have maybe different layers of referral sources, and you know whether you could decide who the specific person is to refer that person to, or you send it to someone else who might be helpful. That's sort of a judgment call at the moment.
I think that, you know, all people that come into our offices are expecting confidentiality. Number two, in terms of people that I'm going to address two different kinds of situations. One, people that are out of work, and people looking for financial assistance. And they're not necessarily one and the same. We could have now about 90 families we're dealing with financially, and about 400 people looking for work. So people that are looking for work, you want to see whether their skill sets match up with jobs that you get in, or you want to see whether you can hook them up with people that can help people with those job sets. People, even if now we're about to launch a job board, people are recommending that resumes go on that job board for potential employers to see, they're never going to have names. No one needs to know names. People, if they are interested in whatever that resume seems to show, they'll call us and then we'll make the proper connection. In terms of financial confidentiality, that's a very big given. The people that go through providing their numbers, it's very difficult for them to go through that process. It's almost like doing financial root canal. And it's very sensitive, and very often it generates a lot of shalom bias issues. And you know, you have to try to be there for them, and they have to have a tremendous sense that whatever it is that you're doing for them, you're doing with the greatest degree of sensitivity and preservation of dignity. But in terms of triage of resources, that's exactly what they're looking for you to try to help them figure out. Many of the people, even if they are working, even when they were working, as Rabbi Billet suggested earlier, to live within a, let's call it a suburban or a Jewish community where people have to pay for education on top of a mortgage, on top of everything else, in order to be able just to pay regular bills is challenging. I think it was the President Obama who drew a $200,000 line where you're in a higher echelon within the economic strata. And the truth of the matter is, in the Jewish community, if you have a family of three or four children and you're paying a bunch of tuitions and you have to pay mortgage, by the end of the day, there are many schools that offer scholarships to people earning $200,000. So it is financially very challenging. So in the event that a family is short, yes, you want to try to hook them up with people in the community that can be sensitive and will be willing to provide services where need pro bono and where able at a reduced rate. And this is something that, yeah, we should be doing and always taking into consideration kavod abrios, human dignity.
Thank you very much indeed. Now question from a rabbi in the Five Towns. What is a rabbi's role in encouraging people? How far is it legitimate to encourage people to cut down on excessive spending? Should rabbi send a message to the community, including the affluent, at a time like this, to lower the level of excessive spending on bar mitzvahs, on weddings, on conspicuous consumption at times like that? Or is that a message that is not really appropriate to give to private individuals at any time? Billet.
Interesting that a rabbi from the Five Towns should ask that question. I wonder who he is. I think that that's a difficult question. We all have friends who are caterers, and we want the caterers to make a parnassa as well. I think that it is a good idea for a group of rabbis in a particular neighborhood to try to work with the caterers and to work with the people and to set standards. There are certain types of parties where the spending is just excessive. It has nothing much to do with the caterer. It has to do with the trappings of the party, the ambiance of the party. I think that it would be a tremendous chesed if even those who could afford would be prepared to cut back a little bit and make the parties a little simpler. Perhaps we don't need the famous singer called in for the half hour appearance or whatever it may be, and we can cut down on the expense of flowers and other decorations, and even on the number of courses. And that way, it puts less social pressure on those who can't afford, and it also just brings us a little bit down to reality. It makes more money available to the community. I think that is a very, very good idea. A number of years ago, the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, the leaders of the Aguda community, tried to impose real specific standards on how many courses. It didn't work. This is the kind of thing that if it can't be done in a way that it's going to work, it doesn't pay to do it, because if people don't listen, and then it becomes a joke. But if people listen, or a significant number of people are prepared to listen, I think it could be something that would be a tremendous service to those people who are in need, and to the general Jewish community in general, in the Chalal, as I say.
Rabbi Billet, thank you for that. I'd like to add my own personal experience on that, because as we have these economic downturns, and of course it's very important for a rabbi, and I, for one, will admit to colleagues here on the around the table or joining us on the net that this is very, very difficult balance to get right. One needs to encourage people to lower their level of consumption and not to put pressure on one another. At the same time, at least in my experience, certainly this economic downturn, and particularly the way it's affected people's investments, has led to some of the most affluent people of the community, we're still, thank God, very, very affluent, nonetheless, feeling a tremendous sense of loss, of reversal of financial financial fortune, just because of the sums of money that they have lost. And my experience, and I must say I learned this really by fire, is that one has to be extremely careful about not allowing the wealthy at this time, of course, who are charitable, remain charitable, to feel that suddenly we're pointing the finger at them now when they're going through a difficult time, and turning our ire on them as rabbis. And I agree with Rabbi Billet that it has to be done with exceptional sensitivity. I have a question here which I'm going to address to Mr. Lahr, because it's sort of legal in nature. Say, comes from a rabbi in Dallas. From time to time we see advertisements for non-profit organizations that offer assistance in debt reduction. Are these programs legitimate? And should congregants in financial distress be referred to such programs as they would be to government-assisted programs? If so, are there specific programs that should be pursued or avoided?
That's a very good question as well. My understanding of that industry is that there are not-for-profits, but don't assume that every not-for-profit is really not-for-profit. That somebody doesn't create a job out of a not-for-profit, and that these agencies aren't charging fees and getting percentages on the debt reduction. There are certainly agencies or companies out there that advertise. You hear on the radio, call us up, we'll get your $20,000 credit card bill reduced or forgiven. I'm not sure how legitimate all those places are, but I would certainly be cautious. A better recommendation in communities where there are things like Project Ezra or the Eliezer Project, I believe those are things that those projects are very involved in assisting with, and maybe within other communities, with the assistance of some of the organizations that have already put this together, could assist other communities in putting similar projects together in their communities. But I know, at least I know of these two projects, debt reduction, mortgage renegotiation, things like that are all part of the package of services that they're trying to provide to the community.
I'd like to, many thanks, Mr. Nard. I'd like to ask a question now and start with the rabbis on the panel, but the question is to do with, specifically to do with day school, and a number of the speakers have already alluded to the terrible financial crisis that can be involved in helping parents fund day school tuition. Let's, for example, talk about a family who has perhaps lost one income or seen a substantial drop in their income. We have all, rabbis, heard of people contemplating, thinking out loud, removing the children from yeshiva, talking about homeschooling, talking about sending kids to public school and encouraging shuls to consider opening up Hebrew schools to provide the gap in tuition or in Jewish education. What should a rabbinic community response to this be? Is it legitimate to help families pay for tuition? Is it legitimate to help a family negotiate a reduction in tuition? How can rabbis work with schools to make day school tuition become more affordable? Is it a priority to be raising money at this time for scholarship endowments? We'll start with Rabbi Stern and then Rabbi Billet, if you'd be so kind.
I'm going to take the liberty, since I'm up here, just to add one thing to what Mr. Lauer recommended on the last question as well. I think every rabbi should reach out to people within their community who might be either bankruptcy attorneys or attorneys that have dealt with negotiations of credit cards, and seek and see whether they're willing to help families out. I think you would be amazed to see how many wonderful, good people there are who are willing to help other people. That's number one. Number two, in terms of tuitions, we deal with this every single year and for quite a number of people. And I think it has to be dealt with and should be dealt with in the following way. Number one, if, for example, we know of a family situation, and I assume people in Project Eliezer know of a given family situation, then it is definitely within their purview to speak to the right people on the given school and share with them that tremendous amount of due diligence has been done. And even if for whatever reason you have questions about the given family, but we know right now where they're at, and we're making sure that their monies are going for basic living, which I believe everyone is entitled to as an inalienable right to first provide living for the family, then it's been my experience that at least all the schools, or 95% of the schools that I've dealt with, and I deal with every single school that everybody sends kids to within Bergen County and beyond, they're going to be very, very responsive and very helpful in helping that family out. If, however, you get to a specific situation, and it comes up, you know, very frequently when you have children with special needs where the tuition is even considerably higher, for schools that can't afford to give as much of a scholarship that the families actually need, where they can't afford anything, then, yeah, it is for sure incumbent upon organizations like Project Eliezer or Rabbi's Discretionary Funds to come to the aid of such families to ensure that their children's Jewish education will be continued. However, I'd like to caution that please make sure that if you as a rabbi get up and speak with the school and you offer that you're going to do A, B, C, D, or E, don't offer it unless you're really going to do it. And I think that's a very, very important point. I don't want to come across as if I'm saying anything negative about Rabbanim, but I want to just share one story that perhaps people should at least be cognizant of. There was a young lady who went to a school in Israel, and her father had died after being comatose for 4 years, and the mother earned barely an income. The child went to Israel, And obviously, she had no money to pay for the tuition, and the school refused to release the transcript. The child, this young lady, couldn't graduate and couldn't go on to graduate school. So I called the head of that school, and I offered to give half of the tuition now, half of the tuition of 4 weeks, because I wanted to ask her shul rabbi to help raise the other half of the tuition. And this particular head of the school's response was that if you're guaranteeing it, I'm fine. And then he wanted to know why we couldn't wait until all the money came in. I said, why extend the agmas nefesh, the aggravation, for even a second more? He said he has been in the situation over the course of the years that rabbis have promised to do A, B, C, D, and E, and it never came to fruition. Schools are willing to work with anyone who they perceive as being credible. Help them raise the funds, but please, whatever we do, we need to make sure that what we say we're going to do, we do.
Okay, I'm going to try to make a couple of brief points. I said, I think in my presentation, I think now is the time to try to reach out to the community to help raise funds for the schools, for all of our schools. YU had a conference this past summer at Champions Gate where the main theme of the conference was the tuition crisis. We recently had an event in our community where YU brought a coach from PEACH, the Project for the Enhancement of Jewish Education, to teach schools also. And a lot of schools, maybe some schools are a little bit arrogant about this, and they shouldn't. It's important for schools to come up with new fundraising strategies, new cost reduction strategies. An idea that came up in our neighborhood, for example, was perhaps if schools are buying the same kind of fuel to buy as a group, schools should pull together. If they're giving insurance policies, should pull together and buy as a group insurance policies. You can get it a little bit cheaper. I come from a family where my father was a very, very hardworking man. He came over from Europe, and he taught me that one penny plus one penny plus one penny eventually adds up to a dollar. We shouldn't be too proud to say that a couple hundred dollars here and a couple hundred dollars there is a big savings for a school. I think priorities of families have to be examined in terms of. I've had families who've gone away who can't pay tuition, gone away to California for Pesach programs, and they say it's my mother-in-law is paying for the Pesach program. I think that people should be told that their mother-in-law perhaps should pay for tuition and not for Pesach programs. People should be told to try to reach out to family members. I think another topic that has to be considered, because today it's almost a necessity, are summer programs for kids. Many kids go away, and then some kids are left home, but maybe there could be creation of jobs for kids who can't go to camp or whatever, where they can get together with other kids and be working together. We have to come up with all sorts of different important strategies to deal with this tuition crisis. The subject of public school per se has come up in our community. Unless we're prepared to take over the public schools en masse, I think public schools are not a great environment to send our kids. The PEACH and the people at YU brought the Champions Gate, in fact, had and I think there's actually a CD that was produced of the session. The session was a phenomenal session. They went over all the different possibilities, including the public school possibility. And I think it's something that we have to give a lot of thought to, but I think that public school would be the last option that I would want to consider, given who else goes to public school and the environment of public school and the importance of strong Jewish continuity, and especially at a young age, of having the social environment of peers who are of similar background, peers who have similar commitments. That gives a lot of strength to kids to be able to buckle down and learn Jewish values in addition to their general secular values. Thank you. That was a message. My thing is shut off.
I just wanted to add two or three thoughts. In my capacity as chairman of a large day school on Long Island, I think it's important for Rabbanim to understand, in the context of running a yeshiva, that picking out students and putting them into public school could be disastrous to the yeshiva system that we've built. If there's an organized effort, like maybe in Florida, where there's a charter school or something like that, maybe it's a different concept if the community does it together. But understand that students coming out of yeshiva, A, is detrimental to the yeshiva system that we've built, but also to the continuity of Jewish education that we've strived to attain. So it's important to understand the give and take before we address a specific issue. I think Rabbi Billet's point is very well taken as well. We in yeshivot see parents who can't pay tuition and then they go away for Pesach. And we ask them, how do you go away for Pesach? You're taking scholarship, you told us you can't afford anything. And they say, well, my parents are paying for it. I think it's incumbent upon Rabbanim to speak to the community and to set everybody's priorities straight. And that means not only the parents and the Baal Batim who are facing the issues, but also the grandparents and others who could assist, so that they understand that before you take your family away for vacation or something like that, that you address the needs, the actual needs of supporting the family and paying for yeshiva tuition. I think people need to understand that yeshivas have limited resources. They have teachers to pay, they have children to educate, they have limited scholarships, and that efforts such as what happened in our community are important in terms of collaboration. Something simple like Rabbi Billet thinking ahead of the curve, calling up Yeshiva University, putting together this program where virtually every yeshiva in that region came together to try to address this issue together rather than on a one-off basis. And collaboration is important. As I mentioned, I think just as with Yeshiva University, yeshivot and the yeshiva system that we've put together over the years is extremely important, needs to be supported, and is vital to our continuity.
Going to draw our most stimulating program to an end, I would like to thank, first of all of our participants for sharing with us tremendously their professional experience and their knowledge. Rabbi Stern, Rabbi Billet, Professor Melendretas, and Mr. Lauer. We've learned so much, so very much this morning going into this afternoon about the necessity of rabbis helping people to understand the current reality, not in any way trying to shield people from their financial responsibilities or to pretend that this crisis is something which is simply going to blow over very soon. Communities have to come together. Rabbis have a pivotal role in helping, encourage, and inspire people to give not only financial resources, but at this time what I'm hearing even more, professional help, networking, availability. Rabbis have to provide unstinting support and also love and on some occasions tough love with members, with community members, in order to understand exactly what it is that people need to do to together pull through this tremendous financial crisis. I want to thank very much our most capable organizers of today's event, Rabbi Krimsky, who's done a sterling job, and Rabbi Mostovsky, and also the technical team behind the camera and arranging that the webcast should go as well as it has. I also want to close by announcing that the next one of these series, the second of this two-part series, will take place at this time next week on Tuesday, January 13th, between 11 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. This is going to be the pastoral component. It's going to be moderated by Rabbi Jonathan Schwartz of Elizabeth, New Jersey, and we'll have the participation of Dr. David Polkovitz, Dr. Sarah Barris, and Rabbi Shmuel Golden, and we'll talk about the rabbi's pastoral responsibilities to helping people in this time of unprecedented financial crisis. I would like to wish everybody a Tzom Kal, an easy but meaningful fast, again to reiterate our prayers and feelings of solidarity with Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael, those who are undergoing financial crisis here, and those who are undergoing the most unbelievable stress and sakana and danger and fighting on behalf of all of us in Eretz Yisrael. Thank you.